Today on the 21st show, conspiracy theories are spreading beyond elections and vaccines to where people are now lying about the weather and making accusations about your local meteorologist.
That we're somehow part of a government cover-up, that somehow the hurricanes are targeting red states. That's so many ludicrous claims, and the craziest part, none are based in science whatsoever.
Scientists, doctors, journalists, and now even the weathermen are being targeted by the purveyors of disinformation. We'll talk about the problem and what we might do about it. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. It's not uncommon for TV meteorologists to receive unfriendly emails from viewers. But lately, those comments have ramped up to the point where some are reporting being threatened. And this seems to be driven by online conspiracy theories. Here's meteorologist Matthew Cappucci with The Washington Post and My Radar speaking last week on NBC.
It's been an inundation of conspiracy theories, people who believe that we're manufacturing the hurricanes, that we're somehow part of a government cover-up, that somehow the hurricanes are targeting red states. So many ludicrous claims, and the craziest part, none are based in science whatsoever. There are people who think we're manipulating hurricanes, creating them, and realistically, you know, one hurricane burns through about more energy than the entirety of the world's energy production times 200. A hurricane might have the energy of 10,000 nuclear bombs. And so to see these ideas proliferating on social media is not only alarming, but I think indicative of kind of American culture at this point.
We're used to disinformation around elections leading to threats of violence directed at poll workers and local election officials. But with hurricanes Milton and Helene hitting swing states ahead of the presidential election, the conditions were right for a flood of lies on social media and even from elected officials. Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican congresswoman from Georgia, tweeted a quote, "They control the weather." Meanwhile, former president and current Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump falsely said FEMA was nowhere to be found in North Carolina, which even Republican officials in flood-ravaged areas say is not only false, but dangerous. So how did we get to the point where even the weather and disaster response has become politicized? And how can we get out of this? Joining us now is Megan Amundo, a research scientist at Arizona State University, though she's originally from Aurora, Illinois. Her doctorate is in psychology. She studies how people learn information, and she's conducted research on what makes people susceptible to misinformation around climate change. Megan, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Zoya Tierstein, a reporter covering climate politics at GRIST, the climate-focused news site. Zoya, thank you for joining us as well.
Very glad to be here.
And finally, Chris Gloninger is a senior climate scientist at the Woods Hole Group in Boston, but he spent decades as a TV meteorologist. He made headlines last summer after he left KCCI in Des Moines, Iowa, because of hostility from some viewers over his mentions of climate change in his forecasts. Chris, great to have you with us.
Happy to be here.
So, Chris, I want to begin with you. You were hired to be chief meteorologist at KCCI in Des Moines to ramp up their climate coverage. Why did you take that job?
It was a natural career pivot. I made it into a top 10 TV market, which was Boston, which was a career goal. And it was a natural kind of progress of my career. I started the country's first weekly series on climate change during my time in Boston. And it gained the attention of a news director out in Des Moines who reached out asking if I would be interested in the chief meteorologist job. And I thought it was an important audience to relay climate science and the importance of adaptation and mitigation, why we should be doing this. I saw it as a great opportunity. So I jumped at it and spent 2 years there and left, obviously, prematurely.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get to that in a moment. But, you know, I think broadcasters have to deal with a certain amount of ridicule from the public. For you, when did that go from, you know, your forecast was off or I don't like your necktie to threats against your life?
I mean, right, if you call for a sunny day and you have rain on your wedding day, you're not going to be too happy. And that's comes with the territory. We anticipate those emails. And the funny thing is, if we could control the weather, right, we wouldn't have a busted forecast. So going back to your original point. But it happened about a year in. I received a series of harassing emails, and then it reached a fever pitch when I received the death threat, which ended with police investigating, arresting, and then fining the individual who sent them. And listening a year after the fact to the police recording of the interview, the man had felt he did nothing wrong. He felt it was protected free speech, and that simply isn't the case. But it was really since 2016 that it went from a tone of, oh, your forecast was a bust. You know, you are an idiot. You're not good at your job. To really hate-filled emails that were threatening. And I think that was the turning point in 2016.
So I want to play a little clip here from your last broadcast. This is July 2023.
Now, I'm walking away from a career, an 18-year career in television that I dreamed of since second grade, so that's why I'm a little emotional. And I can't thank KCCI enough for the opportunity to become chief meteorologist. I'm not giving up, I'm just reinventing myself, finding ways that I can make a bigger difference with climate change, more important than ever as the Earth recorded three of its warmest days, now four of its warmest days this week. This move will also allow us to take care of our family, who's been battling some health issues over the last year, so I just want to thank you for watching. I will be forever grateful.
And we're grateful that we got to.
All right, Chris. So as you listen back to that, as you've been seeing meteorologists in recent weeks receiving more of the threats like the one you did, talk about the parallels with your story.
Right, it's the same. And the people that believe in weather modification, that it's happening, are the same people that harassed me during my time on air saying that climate change is a hoax. But that's what's truly shocking, that people are all in on the idea that what you aired of Matthew Cappucci saying that we are creating these storms, we are steering these storms. They're taking that concept and running with it. But yet the modification of the weather that we are doing by way of burning fossil fuels, that's hogwash. Absolutely not. We're not doing that. And yet there's more evidence of that us climate scientists and meteorologists have, that humans are causing climate change, than doctors have, than the medical community has, that smoking causes cancer. So we have that evidence, but yet that is a bunch of, you know, BS, right? But then you have these off the rail theories that are gaining momentum and traction by a certain congresswoman who you mentioned tweeted it, and then her army of followers on X and so-called journalists that take it and disseminate it and amplify it. And that's the dangerous times we're in right now.
Zoya Tierstein with GRIST, the climate news site. What's been fueling some of these conspiracy theories around Helene and Milton in particular, that this idea that government controls the weather?
Oh, well, there's a lot to unpack there. I think that the first thing is that a lot of the stuff that you initially see online following a major hurricane, this happens a lot. FEMA is long used to dispelling rumors around hurricanes and conspiracies. A lot of that comes from bots, right? Not even real people online. And then the problem is that they're then amplified by public figures like Alex Jones or Elon Musk or Marjorie Taylor Greene or Donald Trump. And that's really when people start to, when that starts to gain momentum, where it feels like, well, something as patently untrue as the government controls the weather, if Donald Trump, is hinting that might be right, then you feel as a person with that theory, you might feel empowered to continue, kind of amplifying that. So that's the first thing, is that, it sort of starts with a lot of bots and less real people. And then it quickly kind of snowballs into a sort of a crisis. And what's interesting about this, and I'll just say one more thing about sort of the origins of these conspiracies, is that it is you know, true that the government at one point tried to, during the Cold War, tried to figure out how to control hurricanes. I mean, how handy would that be if you could divert a hurricane from the Gulf Coast, for example? They were unsuccessful. That program was shuttered because turns out it's really hard to control the weather. So some of these things do have, you know, Alex Jones, you know, the Sandy Hook conspiracy theorist, put out a video that racked up millions of views about how, you know, the government has this program, and you know, and that is that was true, right? So there's like a kernel of truth, but the reality is that it didn't work. So you know, it's been an interesting thing to see these sort of the growing tide of conspiracy theories online.
The growing tide. How many puns are we going to work in here today? And it, I suppose there's even a deeper vein in American life. If you go back to the 1800s and the rainmakers who would come to town and people would, the original American con was people going to these desert towns or parched areas and trying to sell rainmaking. Zoya, there was also misinformation or disinformation this time around the disaster response, FEMA in particular, the Federal Emergency Management Agency after Helene. What were some of those false reports, and what was the effect of that in North Carolina?
Yeah, and this is actually one of the most heartbreaking pieces of what's happened in the aftermath of Helene, and it's still ongoing in many ways. So immediately after the storm struck, and this happens often, I will say, it's not the first time that FEMA has faced blowback. People really expect to see the government immediately on the ground. They expect to see FEMA personnel in vests, you know, carrying sandbags and digging people out. And that's just not how that agency works. FEMA is a check writing organization. They help local governments pay for the costs, the astronomical costs that they could never, you know, shoulder themselves, those governments, of cleaning up and responding to disasters. What happens after something like Helene, where, you know, the impacts were expected in Florida, and then, you know, you had this really, really intense impacts in Asheville, for example, in North Carolina, in Western North Carolina, Georgia, et cetera. And the problem there is that, you know, there is this feeling of intense chaos. It is never, ever easy or straightforward. You know, disasters create, by definition, mayhem. And so in the aftermath of that, there was this theory that gained a lot of steam that was amplified by the public figures I mentioned earlier, that FEMA, you know, was nowhere to be found, that the government was not helping, that it had abandoned the people of Appalachia, which, you know, we can also discuss the origins of that there is a kernel of truth there too. But in this case, you know, it was untrue. The government was trying to get fit, you know, there's a giant federal apparatus that sort of groans into motion following a major disaster. And you know, it takes time to get supplies and aid down there. And then there was another theory that, you know, that FEMA was confiscating donated goods, and that was also not true. There's no evidence to back that up. I think that people get confused when FEMA starts to say, "Don't send any more goods. We have a lot of goods." It's its own struggle to even organize the amount of stuff that we're getting. You know, we need to prioritize getting resources out that we already have. And then also people decide to, you know, show up to the disaster zone as well, volunteers who have good intentions, but you have untrained people coming into disaster zone who have not even brought their own, you know, power bars. And so that becomes its own issue where, you know, you have to now deal with people who don't really know what they're doing. So it's a real cluster, I will say. And that, I think, is partially why conspiracy theories bloom in the aftermath of these events.
And we need to take a break in a few minutes here. But Megan Amundo, I want to bring you into the conversation, research psychologist at Arizona State. What makes people more susceptible to this sort of disinformation or misinformation during a natural disaster?
Well, as Zoya said, I mean, the mayhem and the chaos that occur after a climate disaster provide a ripe breeding ground for conspiratorial thinking, for reliance on misinformation, because there's a lot of doubt, there's a lot of confusion, and there's a large amount of information to sort through. And so when we think about reasons why someone might rely on conspiratorial thinking during this period of time, you know, there are knowledge reasons, you know, challenges with processing uncertainty, especially with these big events, having confusion and doubt as to who to trust, how to sort through the different kinds of information that's being thrown at them, potentially while they have a spotty internet connection or a spotty ability to even engage with these sources deeply, right? You know, we heard of people, you know, really managing the batteries on their cell phones because they had limited access to power. So maybe they couldn't necessarily do deep dives into, you know, a particular story or website. There's also, you know, these existential factors that come into play during climate, you know, disasters, this desire to perhaps regain some amount of autonomy or feelings of control over one's life or one's circumstances, you know, rather than this being an act of nature that, you know, was outside of my control. You know, I have someone to blame, I have a person who I can point to establish a really clear, simple cause for what is going on. And then there are also many social dynamics, right? These are folks that are in not just local social communities, but also potentially in online communities. And so folks are using those social dynamics to help guide their decision making, guide their evaluation of what's true and what's false. And all of that together provides kind of a hotbed for a lot of confusion and unfortunately a tendency to rely on misinformation and conspiracy theories during a time where really these beliefs and these decisions can be a matter of life or death for people.
All right, we are going to take a break. Let me reintroduce our guests. We are speaking with Megan Emundo, who is a research scientist at Arizona State University, Chris Gloninger, who is a climate scientist at Woods Hole Group and was a longtime television meteorologist, and Zoya Tierstein, who covers climate politics for the news site called Grist. You can join our conversation today at 800-222-9455. Maybe you've seen friends or family members, people on your social media circles sharing misinformation related to weather. How do you respond to that? How do you talk to your loved ones about climate change as well? Let us know at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. Before we do, I do want to mention you can find our program now on YouTube. You can find that by searching for our home station, Illinois Public Media. All right, we'll be back in 90 seconds. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking today about misinformation and disinformation and how it's now even coming for the weather. You can join us today at 800-222-9455. We're talking about this with Zoya Tierstein, a reporter covering climate politics at Grist, and Megan Emundo, who's a research psychologist at Arizona State University, who studies how people learn information and what makes them susceptible to misinformation, particularly around climate. And also we are joined by Chris Gloninger, a former TV meteorologist who's now a senior climate scientist at the Woods Hole Group in Boston. Again, 800-222-9455. Chris, I want to play another clip here of a meteorologist and hurricane specialist in Florida, John Morales. This moment where he's talking about, this is the moment where he's talking about Hurricane Milton and becomes emotional, and it went viral.
Incredible hurricane. It has dropped. It has dropped 50 millibars in 10 hours. I apologize. This is just horrific. Winds, maximum sustained winds are 160 miles per hour. And it is just gaining strength in the Gulf of Mexico, where you can imagine the winds, I mean, the seas are just so incredibly hot. record hot, as you might imagine. You know what's driving that. I don't need to tell you. Global warming, climate change, leading to this and becoming an increasing threat.
Chris, I wonder what your reaction to that moment was and why you think meteorologists need to talk about climate change.
You know, after you see or hear about a mass shooting, a school shooting in particular, you often hear, oh, now is not the time to talk about gun control measures and gun safety. I heard a lot of that, too, during my time covering extreme weather and saying now is not the time to have conversations about climate change and connecting the dots between extreme weather and climate change. That was John coming, you know, having that realization that what he's been warning about for decades is happening. Now, with climate science and attribution science, it's difficult for us to see the frequency of hurricanes and how many hurricanes we see over the course of a given season and what impacts climate change has on that. But we are seeing a clear connection between rapid intensification, and that is the moment he gets choked up, because we have water temperatures, the warmth of those water temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico, 800 times more likely. 800 times more likely because of climate change. So what he's been talking about is happening in real time. And the National Weather Service mission is to provide forecasts that that protect life and property. But I don't think that that's unique to them. Meteorologists get into this field to do just that. We lived through a childhood event that was so impactful that we wanted to make a difference in the field and help protect people. And he knows that this is going to come with catastrophic losses. I'm good friends with John, a colleague for a long time. And I mean, that was a real true moment right there. And you can kind of see and you can hear certainly in his voice, what we've been warning about is happening. It's here, it's right now.
And, you know, talk about this idea, because for a long time, we as journalists were trained, oh, you can't link any one particular bad weather event or even a weather disaster to climate change. But I understand there are people who are trying to push the bounds of that science and actually be able to establish those links in much closer to real time than, you know, an academic paper that comes out 3 or 5 years later. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, attribution science has come a long way. The annual American Meteorological Society conference in Baltimore last winter had a heavy focus on this science and the turnaround time. Now, with things like temperature and ocean warmth, we can see near real-time data, which really helps with the messaging, right? You can show the influence climate change is having on these events, like what John said during that clip. Other events, it takes a little bit more time, but we're refining that. My only issue with that, though, is, Brian, when the news cycle, I mean, with a certain political, person out there that makes news every time he opens his mouth, the rest of the news gets covered up. So when you have a storm that happened 5 days ago, even if it was catastrophic, we're on to the next thing. And I think that loses momentum and the attribution science that does say, hey, this was made 100 times more likely because of climate change. Well, that falls into the abyss and you don't hear about it, unfortunately. So we made progress. We still need to hasten that connection or finding those connections.
Megan, you have studied the quote unquote both sides-ism of climate change discussions, right? Scientists say the Earth is warming, others disagree. Talk about that, what it is, and what your findings were.
Yeah, so, you know, presenting both sides of an issue is a common way that can be used to maintain objectivity, either in an argument or in, you know, certain kinds of journalistic practices. But definitely this both sidism can have some negative consequences for readers or listeners, particularly when there's an imbalance in expert support for one side versus the other. So in the case of climate change, for example, reading reports that give equal weight to the contrasting viewpoints that climate change is real or that it is not real can make people more skeptical about the existence of climate change. And so research that I conducted with my colleague, Dr. David Brapp at Northwestern University, actually showed that if we present those two viewpoints on climate change, but then additionally inform readers that, you know, 99% of climate science experts agree that climate change is occurring and is a worrisome problem, we can actually counteract the effects of both-sidism and really help people form a more accurate understanding of the state of climate science to, you know, what we hope to inform, you know, accurate, you know, understandings of what they should be doing or supporting to mitigate climate change moving forward.
Chris, do you remember when it clicked for you that climate change was affecting the big weather events that you were warning people about on television?
Yeah, and that was when I worked for NBC. I was part of a task force that would go and help cover hurricanes. And it was during Hurricane Harvey when my photographer and I were, you know, just covered in rain gear from head to toe. Our camera and our microphone audio equipment were covered in waterproof gear, but yet water found a way in. And right, it was a week's worth of just a deluge. And to know and see those rainfall totals and know that for every 1 degree of warming, the atmosphere holds 7% more moisture. And that's how it manifests. That's how we can see the impacts of climate change. And that's when I went to station management and said, we need to be doing more. That was my aha moment. That's, you know, shifting the focus from what's happening in, you know, with Arctic sea ice or the land glaciers melting seems far away. But this is happening in the United States. We're watching it play out in real time, and the impacts are devastating. So that was my turning point.
Chris, according to a New York Times article about your departure, you were accused by the news director at KCCI of being too, quote unquote, preachy in your forecasts, using the words climate change too much. What's your response to that?
You know, it was funny. I saw just an influx of people saying, you know, you're brought in to do the weather. And I think my moment of affirmation was
stick to somebody sports, that, right? Like they say for athletes.
Right. When I saw a tweet from a colleague in the industry that went for my job, that interviewed for my job, saying that they wanted somebody to talk about climate change. So I hope they're being supportive of him. And that's the feedback I got. And that's, again, kind of highlights and shows the dangerous times we're in. If we're allowing the people that are helping these conspiracy theories flourish dictate what we cover on the news, they're allowing them to have editorial coverage. And look, I upended a comfortable life in Boston, made a sacrifice, and then to be told not to do something when you were hired to do something, I mean, was unacceptable. So I really didn't have a choice, and it was too big of an issue to stay silent. So that's why I reinvented myself in my career to make more of a meaningful impact on climate solutions through adaptation and mitigation.
Zoya Tierstein with Grist, what is your understanding, what is your mental model for why climate change has become so politicized?
Well, I mean, how much history should we get into? I think the fossil fuel lobby has done sort of amazing work in turning the issue into a political one. I think there was a sort of a precious decade a few decades ago when it seemed like there was the possibility of bipartisan climate action. That possibility felt totally, totally within reach. I mean, George Bush was talking about it. There was a lot of discussion in Congress about climate change.
I think it was John McCain and Lindsey Graham were in favor of cap and trade or something along those lines. Yeah.
Yeah. So there were a lot of ideas being thrown around, and it just didn't seem, you know, intractable. And now, of course, here we are, where the issue continues to get more complicated. This summer, in fact, my colleague and I, Jake, we decided to do a series focused on how climate change is manifesting in American politics up and down ballots across the country. But we didn't look at climate change, the issue, because as you may know, as listeners may know, climate change is not really a top voter priority at all. When push comes to shove, voters care about the economy, inflation, et cetera. But we contended that actually climate disasters were shaping local politics across the country. And what we found is that that's very much true. So whether or not, you know, people recognize that it's an issue, whether they want to call it climate change or not, it is fundamentally changing people's lives all across the U.S.
In what ways are we talking? Like insurance? Say more about how people
insurance
are seeing this manifest.
Insurance is definitely one. I also looked at how, for example, I went to Lake Charles, Louisiana, which was hit by two back-to-back hurricanes starting in 2020, and then a winter freeze, and then a spring flood. So if your house wasn't flooded the first two hurricanes, or flooded during the winter freeze when your pipes froze and burst, then it was flooded in the spring. And what was interesting about that is that there was a census, as you all remember probably, 2020 census happened right before those disasters hit. It didn't capture the sort of population movement and exodus out of Lake Charles and then also within Lake Charles, which has fundamental repercussions for, you know, who is represents you in your district, you know, what your how much resources your state gets, et cetera. So I found that there's actually a lot of incentive for politicians not to update their population numbers after a major disaster because you lose resources from the state and the federal government if you do that. So that's one example. And then I also went to Vermont just a few weeks ago to look at how a great big flood there in 2023 affected housing in the state, especially in the state's capital, Montpelier. So, you know, there's countless examples of this. I would love to talk about it more, but I feel like those two examples are really indicative of, you know, it's housing, it's resources, it's really everything.
All right. If you want to join us, the number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. We are talking today with Zoya Tierstein from GRIST, Chris Gloninger, who is a senior climate scientist at the Woods Hole Group in Boston, and psychologist Megan Amundo of Arizona State University. Again, 800-222-9455. We had a caller, Marion from Hampshire. Her audio wasn't great, so I'm just going to read her question. She wanted to ask about what makes people believe misinformation and disinformation. You know, things like weather, as we've been talking about, but also around politics and Pizzagate. It was another example. Megan, can you take that? What do we understand about why people believe these things?
Yeah, there are a lot of factors that go into why someone might believe a piece of false information. You know, one of the primary issues we come up with is exposure and repetition. So people are often confronted with statements that they're exposed to in daily life, in conversations, but also in social media, that they may not necessarily have the prior knowledge to evaluate whether it's true or whether it's false. And so that can create an opening to kind of be susceptible to false statements. You know, a particular concern with social media, digital media more broadly, is the issue of repetition. So we find that the more that a piece of false information is repeated, the more sort of truthy it becomes. Its perceptions of truthfulness increase. And so perhaps a statement that might be disregarded on the first exposure or the second time that you hear it maybe starts to take on some elements of feeling truthful on the third or the fourth or the fifth time. And that has to do with feelings of fluency, familiarity. It becomes something that is a little bit more, you know, comfortable to process in your brain. And then, of course, there are issues of what we like to call confirmation bias. So the tendency for people to seek out information that already aligns with viewpoints that they have or tendencies that they have. And so this can be a real concern when there are so many different ways in which we can now access information. It can lead people to really look at just one source that seems to have the viewpoint that they have, the worldview that they have, and reinforce, you know, time and time again, that viewpoint, solidify that viewpoint, even if it's not necessarily true. So those are all factors that really come into play, not just on social media, but even in daily life and conversations with, you know, one another. These things come up over and over and over again.
Just about 30 seconds and we need to take a break, Megan. But it seems like some of those things could cut against each other, right? If somebody like Chris is, you know, repeatedly pointing out the links between climate change and weather disasters, and yet it doesn't confirm people's pre-existing beliefs, then maybe that repetition doesn't work. It almost works in the opposite way.
Yes, yeah. And what you're touching on is also the issue of source. So who is the messenger of the information? Is that source considered trustworthy? Is that source considered someone that would be giving me true information? That's a whole nother factor that also intersects with these issues of repetition and exposure as well. So that's a great point.
All right, we are going to take another break. 800-222-9455. How do you feel about meteorologists talking about more than the 7-day forecast and linking weather to broader changes in our climate, to global warming? How do you and your loved ones talk about global warming? Give us a call. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. More with Megan Amundo, Chris Gloninger, and Zoya Tierstein when we return. This is the 21st show. Please stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about disinformation, misinformation, and how even now it is coming for the weather. We've seen this affecting public health. We've seen it affecting science, and climate change, global warming has certainly been subject to misinformation or disinformation for a while. But now we're even seeing it come to disaster response and, you know, weather forecasting and discussions of TV meteorology. We're talking about all this with Chris Gloninger, who's a former TV meteorologist, now a senior climate scientist at the Woods Hole Group in Boston. Megan Amundo, a research psychologist at Arizona State University, who studies how people learn and what makes them susceptible to misinformation. And Zoya Tierstein, a reporter covering climate politics at the climate-focused media organization called GRIST. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. 800-222-9455. And let's go to the phones. Terry is calling from Melbourne, Florida on line one. Terry, thanks for calling in.
Yes, hi, Brian. I just wanted to mention, just it was quite a coincidence, but I went to my ear, nose, and throat doctor yesterday, and we got into a discussion of the storms here in Florida, and she had taken her RV all the way to North Carolina to avoid any possible damage to it and came back once the storm had passed on. And I made the remark, I said, well, you know, we're only going to see increased intensity and frequency of these storms because of climate change. And she immediately came back and said, well, I don't think anything that humans are doing have anything to do with about climate change. And I said, well, that is sure unfortunate in that it means there isn't anything we can do about it. And here this woman is a doctor, approximately age 65, a good doctor for me, and trained in science, and yet there she is taking that position.
Terry, thank you so much for sharing that story. I really appreciate it. Megan, how about that? How do you have advice for people to have these conversations?
Yeah, you know, these conversations can be really difficult, especially when you're in a doctor's office and, you know, you're going about your daily life and then this conversation kind of springs up and you know, are feeling like you have to kind of engage with that. You know, one of the key things that we've learned from, you know, research on this topic is that, you know, meeting people where they're at can be a really effective way to start that conversation. So trying not to be super dismissive, not trying to meet emotion to emotion. So heightening, you know, surprise, disgust, anger, contempt. Those are things that kind of psychologically get people to dig their heels in and can create some challenges. And so, you know, what we see is that often prolonged conversations, prolonged empathetic back and forths can be one potential approach to, you know, having these really challenging conversations about topics that are really complex and that we ourselves might not necessarily be experts on. So not trying to present, you know, yourself as knowing anything beyond what you do know, and just meeting that other person in the conversation where they're at, repeating, you know, true, accurate information, and trying to really limit those expressions of anger, frustration, or surprise, and focusing more on what the facts are, what the trusted sources out in the world show, and really leaning into, you know, consensus, right? Experts have a consensus on this. We have a scientific process that works. It's a collective process that's, you know, full of institutions, but also everyday people, right? I'm a scientist, but I'm also a human being as well. And so really leaning into those personal messages can be one way to have these conversations, but I acknowledge that these can be really hard, especially when they spring up on you, you know, in daily life, and you're maybe not expecting it.
You know, Chris, you were trying to mass, you know, communicate with the mass public through your broadcasts, but then you get all these emails from people. And I know, in my experience, I was a state house reporter for 11 years. I know if somebody would say something about tax policy in Illinois, sometimes I would engage them and try and sort of gently lead them to a more correct understanding of the way things actually work. I wonder, did you try to have those one-on-one interactions with people, and did you find any success with that?
I did, yeah. And for a wider audience, I found ways to connect, which I think I was discouraged by some of the coverage in my story when I left originally, because it just said essentially I left. But I did find a great way to connect by finding conservative terminology and philosophies that worked in the climate setting. Like, for example, energy independence. When you had farmers that were getting $15,000 in land leases for wind turbines, it could offset a bad season. But it's also creating energy in your own backyard, and nothing is more independent than that. And also fiscal responsibility. And if we're having these billion-dollar disasters every 2.5 weeks, just letting people build back in the same footprint that got us into the situation that we're in is fiscally irresponsible. So I think that worked. A quick little story that happened. There was a big severe weather outbreak early in the season, about 2 months early, and I forecasted it. And this guy who would fire off an email almost after every weathercast, who would, I think, like to have a drink or two, a cocktail after being out in the farm fields, he called out after the event and said, "How the heck did you call this accurately? No one else had it. The forecast models didn't even show it." And I said, "Because if you look at the Gulf of Mexico, it is this heat pump, and we're at record-breaking warmth, and that's injecting this storm with moisture." And I consider him to be a climate dismissive, but at least I had that one-on-one engagement with him, and we ended up having a pretty meaningful conversation going forward.
Nice. I like that story. All right, let's get another caller in, 800-222-9455. Scott is calling from Central Illinois. Scott, thanks for calling in.
Thanks for having me. I think the real problem is you need to get into people's psychology. When they hear blatant disinformation all the time, they believe it. Joe Jackson, in his song Sunday Paper, says they wouldn't print it if it wasn't true. People fall into this rhythm, and it's virtually impossible to get them out of their disinformation bubble.
No, it's an interesting point, and there it does come with that authority. And, you know, somebody says something in their broadcast television or broadcast radio voice, it does carry a certain weight, some people might say. Scott, thank you so much for calling in. Zoya, what do you think about that?
Definitely. I mean, so I think there's two things there that I want to touch on. The first is that, you know, the local newspapers in this country, the local newsroom network, it has been decimated in recent years. So that's a problem. You know, people don't have a trusted news source to go to, and they are reading a lot of their news online. They're not reading news really. They're reading, in many cases, as I mentioned before, just bots, and taking that at face value. There's another element of this that I have reported on in the past that's very alarming, which is that following disasters, especially far right militias, Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, there's a long history there of them moving into those zones following Hurricane Maria, for example, Hurricane Harvey in Texas, and doling out aid, you know, handing out hot meals and basically trying to burnish their image. And this is something that is right now happening in Western North Carolina. You have Proud Boys on the ground lending their services and basically saying, you know, we're here, where's FEMA? And so you mentioned, you know, having this like authoritative, you know, voice or really just a position of power and presence. A lot of those far right individuals are former sheriffs. They're former policemen. They seem and they really act like they know what they're doing. In many cases, they actually do know what they're doing. They're former firefighters. And so there's this deep, deep confusion and element around, you know, who do you trust? And there you really see this marriage of what's happening online and what's happening on the ground. And that's really where things start to get dangerous.
I want to, as we're coming to the end of our time together, I want to share a quote. It's a piece that Charlie Warzel had in The Atlantic earlier this month about some of these topics. I'm just going to quote from it. He says, "What is clear is that a new framework is needed to describe this fracturing. Misinformation is too technical, it's too freighted, and after almost a decade of Trump, too political, nor does it explain what's really happening, which is nothing less than a cultural assault on any person or institution that operates in reality. If you are a weather person, you're a target. The same goes for journalists, election workers, scientists, doctors, and first responders. These jobs are different, but the thing they share is that they all must attend to and describe the world as it is. This makes them dangerous to people who cannot abide by the agonizing constraints of reality as those who have financial and political interests in keeping up the charade," end quote. Zoya, does that track with your experience here?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. You know, that's something that we're seeing, as I said, play out on the ground. You know, we no longer have the right tools to address what's happening. I think that over the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, especially, you know, FEMA put out a statement actually, and the administrator of that agency said that she had never seen this level of misinformation. So I think that's right. You know, we don't have the right language even. I think Megan could probably speak to this as well, to describe what's going on. We needed a new set of tools to sort of handle the influx of, you know, of whatever this new era really is.
Megan, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely something there. You know, going back to, you know, the time around 2016, where we were often as scholars, as researchers, using terminology like fake news. And then we really, as a community, moved away from that terminology because it became so politicized, because it came to represent something different than what it initially intended. And so we started to rely more on, you know, disinformation, misinformation as terms. And it's definitely possible that as the conversations continue to evolve, that we might need to be rethinking the terminology we're using as it becomes politicized, and think about what other ways can we you know, use to communicate to the public, you know, what is happening on their social media platforms, what is happening, you know, in daily life as they're confronting this false information, so that we can give them the language and the tools that they need to be able to adequately deal with sort of a new norm out there in the information space.
Mm-hmm. All right, just a few minutes left in the show, but we have a really good question on the line. Chris, I think this is directed for you. Mary Jane is calling from Champaign. Mary Jane, thanks for calling in, and I'm going to ask you to please be brief.
Okay. Project 2024 or 25 lists the NOAA and the
National Weather Service?
Weather Station, yes, as one of the targets that they would underfund. How would that affect our knowledge about weather that's coming at us?
Thank you so much for that, Mary Jane. I appreciate it. Chris, can you take that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more to it, too, when it comes to disaster recovery, like what we just had with Milton and Helene. They would essentially get rid of the flood insurance program and privatize it. And look what's happening to private insurance companies, pulling out of Florida, pulling out of Cape Cod, where I am, in Massachusetts. So that's just one other example. But the day-to-day weather operations, I fear for the future of the weather industry, because we really don't have the accuracy of a 10-day forecast or more. So when you have privatized companies competing for that, competing for eyeballs, then you try to push the limits. And I think that will hurt the industry, the profession, and the science. Now that I'm in the field, truly in climate science, I am fearful of what will happen on November 5th. From 2016 to 2020, we were able to tread water and do a lot of good climate work at a local and state level. And we're able to make up for where we weren't doing climate action at the federal level. We cannot do that again for another 4 years. We will not be able to survive that.
A stark warning. Chris Gloninger is with the Woods Hole Group in Boston. Megan Amundo is a psychologist at Arizona State University. And Zoya Tierstein is a reporter covering climate politics at Grist. Thank you all so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for today. Coming up tomorrow, Hispanic and Latino voters have historically favored Democrats, but Donald Trump has cut into that support, which polling suggests is the lowest it's been in 20 years. We'll talk about why more Latinos are voting Republican and what it could mean for this year's elections. We appreciate hearing from you about our shows and your suggestions for future guests or stories. You can contact us by email. talk@21stshow.org is the address. talk@21stshow.org. You can also find that on our website, which is 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is produced by Anna Casey, Christine Hatfield, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Coulson Khan. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.